listening to TJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we explain why the Narwhal's taken the RCMP to court on Red Eye, examine how Canada's export framework allows military goods to bypass oversight and accountability on Palestine Debrief, explore policy interventions to reduce food insecurity in Canada on Green Planet Monitor, and unpack how our interactions with robots are changing our sense of ourselves on Cyborg Goddess. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On this episode, the Narwhal Editor-in-Chief, Carol Linnett, talks about journalist Amber Bracken's 2021 arrest on Wet'suwet'en territory and why they're taking the RCMP to court to defend press freedom. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Lorraine Chisholm speaks with Carol Linnett of the Narwhal about their lawsuit against the RCMP for the arrest of their journalist, Amber Bracken, in 2021.
The Narwhal is an independent, nonprofit online magazine that publishes in-depth and investigative journalism. In 2021, Amber Bracken, a journalist on assignment for the Narwhal, was arrested by the RCMP on Wet'suwet'en territory and held in jail for 3 days. The charges against Amber, a freelance photojournalist based in Edmonton, were later dropped. The Narwhal and Amber Bracken are suing the RCMP in a case about press freedom. That trial begins in Vancouver this coming week. I'm pleased to be joined by Carol Linnett, co-founder and the acting executive director and editor-in-chief of the Narwhal. Hello, Carol.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much for being here. I really admire the work that the Narwhal is doing, so I'm so pleased to have you.
Well, thank you.
Before we dive into Amber's arrest and the case you're bringing against the RCMP, and for those who may not be familiar with the Narwhal, tell us the kind of journalism that you're engaged in.
Yeah, we launched the Narwhal myself and my co-founder, Emma Gilchrist. We launched the Narwhal in 2018 with an eye to producing environmental journalism that wasn't really being done in Canada in the way that we were dreaming of. So many journalists were losing their jobs. So many newspapers were cutting jobs. There weren't a lot of roles for photojournalists. There wasn't oftentimes a lot of resources for in-depth environmental journalism or running big investigations about the environment. Emma and I are both based in Victoria, British Columbia, and in this province of British Columbia, we are, you know, we're the global headquarters of the mining industry. We have an enormous amount of forestry, a lot of oil and gas development, and yet there's not a lot of beat reporters who are just consistently covering these industries from a public interest and accountability perspective. So we started to really dream about what a publication could do if it was really just focused on those issues and bringing the best of the best of digital and new media skill sets with intrepid journalists who could really develop an expertise and really focus on these industries. In the first few years, we were focused in British Columbia, but now, 7 years later, we are doing journalism across the country.
Take us back to 2021, November. What work was Amber Bracken doing in the territory of the Wet'suwet'en Nation?
Amber was there on assignment for the Narwhal to cover whatever was going on at that time in terms of the conflict over the Coastal GasLink pipeline. So when we sent her up there on assignment, it wasn't actually to cover anything in particular. It was a bit of a reconnaissance mission, for lack of a better term. We just, every winter for the previous few years, there had been a protest action and an RCMP enforcement response. And there was a lot of attention on the conflict brewing over this pipeline. And so in November, Amber and I connected, and she had a sense that it was about time to go back up there and just get on the land, talk to people, get a sense of what was going on. And then while she was up there, a major protest action began to unfold, and there was a blockade of the road, and there was an eviction order that was put forward for Coastal GasLink workers from First Nation, asking them to leave the territory, giving them a time frame in which they had to do that. And all of these things began to unfold. And we were grateful as journalists that Amber was there on scene to document that. Her photos were so incredible, just very visceral, very, very captivating, you know, of these protest actions taking place on these snowy roads in the dark. And yeah, it was an incredible story to tell at that time. And then the police enforcement action came into effect, and the RCMP showed up, and they set up a media control access point, and journalists weren't really able to get in further down this road, you know, sort of past this police line. But Amber, because she had already been up there, she was sort of far down the road and ended up being at the last stand for arrest that the RCMP performed. And when the RCMP arrived at this tiny house where a bunch of land defenders and protesters were camped out, barricaded inside this little box, Amber was there to document those arrests. And then to our dismay, she was scooped up in those arrests. Even though she was there as a journalist, she identified herself as a journalist. The Narwhal had reached out to the RCMP to let Amber know she was there on assignment, and she was arrested and charged. She went to jail for many days, and that was really distressing and confusing for us at the time. RCMP officers, previous instances, had done a catch and release sort of arrest or detention of journalists where they would take them away but let them go. But in this instance, she was actually jailed and not let out of jail over the weekend, spent 3 nights. And that was really distressing for us. We were perplexed why that was happening. And it just really compounded the fear and confusion and injury that we really felt at her arrest.
Carol, I think many of us at the time watched the video of the arrest, or one of the videos. What do we see and hear about the interactions between the RCMP and Amber Bracken at that moment?
What you see in that video that so many people across Canada have watched is Amber at the moment of her arrest, or, you know, just as she's being arrested, you hear her say, for the record, I'm a member of the media. I'm here observing. You've been notified that I'm here. And so that is all now evidence in this trial as to the details of when and how and where Amber was and how she conducted herself. And we are arguing and stand very convicted in our assertion that Amber was there as a journalist. She conducted herself as a journalist, and she should not have been arrested.
What were some of the reactions at the time to the arrest of a journalist on the job and the failure to release her immediately?
This was an incredible part of the experience, was experiencing the level of outrage that ensued from everyday people in the public who didn't know much about Amber but knew she was a journalist, to editors at some of our most esteemed publications across the country who were alarmed, you know, having worked with Amber, knowing the caliber of her work and her professionalism, knowing that she had been arrested. And I feel like that alarm and public outrage really grew every single day that she was kept in jail. So there was a tremendous outpouring of support for Amber, cries for her to be released immediately and then eventually demands for accountability that the arrest had taken place.
Why did you decide to sue the RCMP?
A part of our decision has to do with what we experienced a few months prior to Amber's arrest out in Fairy Creek. And the Narwhal's not alone in this. Many publications felt very frustrated at the way journalists were being treated. So this is in a remote area on Vancouver Island. There's not cell phone reception out there. There were these protest actions taking place on these remote logging roads. It was difficult to get out there and expensive and time consuming. And journalists were traveling out to this remote area only to find themselves prevented from actually witnessing the arrests that were taking place because the RCMP were creating these exclusion zones or media control points and basically telling journalists, if you step across this line, we'll arrest you. And those arrests did happen and did take place. And so the Narwhal and a coalition of other media organizations, publications, and also the Canadian Association of Journalists actually banded together and put it to a judge, asked a judge to issue a ruling on whether or not those exclusion zones, the way the RCMP was using them, were legal. Because as journalists, we do have special rights under the charter to perform our journalistic function. And when the RCMP are telling you where you can be, how you can do your job, and if you do not abide by those strictures, they will arrest you, it makes it near to impossible for you to actually perform those journalistic functions. So at the time, a judge issued a ruling saying that the RCMP had actually failed to justify those extensive exclusion zones that they had created. And the judge reminded the RCMP of this special journalistic function, the role journalists play in democracy. And we really felt like we hoped it would be instructive to RCMP to not arrest journalists and to not interfere, but to find a way to work with us when we're on scene and reporting from injunction zones. Fast forward a few months later, and Amber's on scene, and not only is she, you know, interfered with and arrested, but then they pressed charges. She was jailed for many days. We felt like this was outrageous that this had happened. And we knew from an early point that we may want to seek legal recourse because what we really wanted was accountability for the fact that that had happened. And a very powerful way of doing that is asking the courts to weigh in and help journalists understand, help the RCMP understand, what do press freedom rights in Canada mean? What does that actually mean in an injunction zone? Another part of this too has to do with the way that the public and journalists across Canada felt so aggrieved by Amber's arrest. The questions did not stop coming into us at the Narwhal. What are you going to do? And it felt all but impossible to just let this go. It felt like that was just such a tacit acceptance of this treatment of journalists. And that was really hard to swallow and sit with. And so, yeah, there's a lot that went into the decision to actually move forward with this case, of course. It's a big decision, a lot of deliberation. But ultimately, we just felt like we couldn't not move forward with this case and really ask for that accountability.
What do you hope to accomplish concretely through the lawsuit?
So we are suing for a violation or a breach of Amber's charter rights as a journalist. We are also suing for the Narwhal's charter rights being violated. That would be a bit of a novel advancement of the idea of press freedoms for Canadians, to establish that the Narwhal as a publication also has a role to play in what press freedom means for Canadians. Because yes, Amber was jailed and arrested and she was unable to produce her journalism. But as a publication, the Narwhal was unable to publish her photos. She was unable to submit for that assignment. We were not able to publish not only on that news, but to continue to cover the news. You know, what happened after Amber's arrest? No one was there to document that. There is no witnessing of that. There is no public reporting of that. You know, the public record stopped at that moment that Amber's cameras were taken away from her. And so that becomes very dangerous for publications, for editors, and for newsrooms, for teams of journalists. If you're trying to make a decision about where to spend your time and energy and resources, and you're looking at a protest action and an enforcement of an injunction, in a remote area, is there a chance you might say, we don't want to spend $10,000 or $5,000 and 5 days getting a journalist out there because they might just be arrested. Maybe we should cover something else. You know, it really prevents journalists from doing their job, from having access to the places we need to have access to do that job. So, and this is even more important, you know, when it has to do with events that are unfolding in a remote area, when there's sites of conflict, when there's uncertainty about the application of Indigenous rights and the legality of project permitting, and especially in an era of supposed reconciliation and a climate emergency, we really want journalists to be on the ground to cover these for the benefit of all Canadians, to create that factual record. So what we're really hoping is that in advancing these rights and winning this case, that a judge will say what the RCMP did was wrong and will prevent that from happening again in the future.
Now, the case starts, Carol, next week in Vancouver, January 12th. You're going to be down here and you expect it to take 5 weeks or so. How can people engage and show their support?
The trial itself, the court is open to the public. So people are welcome to come in. Court runs every single day from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We'll be there every day for 5 weeks. So people are welcome to come and watch. We have a press freedom page set up at the Narwhal, thenarwhal.ca/pressfreedom. And if you check out that page, you can keep up to date with things that are unfolding in the trial. You can sign up for our newsletter where we will be sharing updates. We are also soliciting donations from the public. This is a big part of this story too, is just the fact that we are able to bring this case because of donations from thousands of individuals. The Narwhal is a small nonprofit, and we are so grateful that the public cares so much about this issue of press freedom. And folks are still, you know, these donations are still just trickling in through our website. We're incredibly honored and grateful. So that's, of course, another tangible way that people can support.
Well, thank you so much, Carol. I really appreciate your talking to me on the eve of this important action. And good luck.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest in the case and for coverage and for taking time.
I've been speaking with Carol Linnett. She's the co-founder, the acting executive director and editor-in-chief of The Narwhal. And you can find The Narwhal, subscribe to their newsletter, and follow this case on thenarwhal.ca.
There's a new interview from Red Eye. Hear more of their high-quality public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal, coming up next. A production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, Palestine Debrief, is a podcast discussing stories, people, issues, and events related to Palestine in a weekly series of interviews with experts, politicians, artists, and activists. On this new episode, the team examine how Canada's export framework allows military goods to bypass oversight and accountability despite human rights violations. Now, here's the show.
Since October 2023, Palestinians in Gaza have endured the first live-streamed genocide in history, one that has shattered nearly every record of the modern world. And Canadian-made weapons have been used in fueling this violence.
Weapons worth almost $80 million would be manufactured by Canada.
While Canadian politicians continue to insist no arms are being sent to Israel, the evidence tells a different story. Through a gigantic loophole in Canadian export law, weapons, parts, and bullets bypass national safeguards and international obligations, landing in the hands of the IOF committing genocide in Gaza. To understand Canada's role, the loophole that makes it possible, and the efforts underway to finally close it.
Speaker, I rise today to introduce my private member's bill, the No More Loopholes Act.
We'll dive into history, unpack policy, and show why this matters. This is the story of how Canada arms Israel's genocide.
We will not have any form of arms or parts of arms be sent to Gaza.
Since the start of the genocide, Canada has been providing political cover through bias, policies, and misinformation about Canadian arms sales to Israel and downplaying the atrocities happening in Gaza. The truth is that Canada is allowing arms companies to sell weapons and profit from Israel's genocide, putting Canada at risk of violating both domestic and international law. We even have a Crown Corporation, the Canadian commercial corporation that uses Canadian tax dollars to help companies sell their arms to the U.S. through the U.S. loophole. On November 18, 2025, the Arms Embargo Now Coalition, of which CGPME is a member of, released a detailed report showing how the Canadian government has been circumventing its own export rules by allowing hundreds of unregulated arms shipments to Israel through the U.S., and further enable Israel's genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank. Also in July 2025, the same coalition released another report exposing Canada's ongoing weapon shipments directly to Israel. Similarly, in January of the same year, Project Plowshares documented that Canadian-made parts were used in every production run of F-35 to date, including the ones sent to Israel. And the scale of these shipments is significant.
What we also just discovered is over 150 shipments of Canadian explosives. These are made in Canada, in Quebec, at General Dynamics factories, and these are being sent to the U.S. Army ammunition plants that manufacture those famous 2,000-pound MK-84 bombs, the 155-millimeter shells, the 120-millimeter tank rounds for Israel. So when we're looking at Israel's weapons, turns out that these bombs have Canadian parts in them. And in fact, the Valleyfield, Quebec plant is the only supplier of the specific triple base propellant that is used for these 155-millimeter artillery shells that Israel has been deploying nonstop in its assault on Gaza.
This makes Canada complicit in genocide.
We have always supported Canada's accession to the Arms Trade Treaty, but we want to do this properly. We want to accede fully to the treaty, not just by half measures.
Canada formally adopted most of the Arms Trade Treaty into domestic legislation in June 2018, promising to regulate its arms exports and prevent those weapons from being used to commit human rights abuses, creating a legal obligation to ensure Canadian weapons do not contribute to war crimes. Yet despite these obligations, Canadian-made weapons continue to reach Israel. By allowing arms sales to continue under these circumstances, Canada is violating both the spirit and the letter of its own laws and the Arms Trade Treaty. This is more than a technicality. It opens Canada up to accountability for human rights abuses and signals to the world that Canadian law can be bent when geopolitical interests are at stake. Every shipment of arms, every component supplied, carries legal and moral weight. Canada is not merely failing to act. It is intentionally allowing corporations to profit from Israel's atrocities against Palestinians. So how does Canada continue to arm Israel's genocide without facing any consequences? How can it export weapons and components to Israel while bypassing their own export regulations? The answer lies in several legal loopholes. The first one is that Canada never adopted Article 6 of the Arms Trade Treaty into domestic law that explicitly bans arming genocides or other crimes against humanity like apartheid. The second is that Canada also didn't adopt Article 4 of the Arms Trade Treaty, which requires states to assess parts and components like they are the full weapons systems. And the third, and by far the largest loophole, dates back to the beginning of the Cold War.
Welcomed in Canada by Mr. Massey, the Governor General, and Mr. Saint Laurent, the Prime Minister, the President of the United States...
In the 1950s, Canada and the US signed a Defense Production Sharing Agreement, DPSA, a pact that deeply integrated their military supply chains. It allowed Canadian firms to sell weapons and components directly to the U.S. Department of Defense. The agreement's original purpose was to reduce procurement barriers and align North American defense production to respond quickly to military demands during the emerging Cold War.
To defend it against the encroachment of international communism in this hemisphere.
This agreement effectively created a North American rather than a sovereign Canadian military-industrial complex. It ensured Canadians' arms manufacturers were fully integrated into the American empire and its geopolitical objectives. But as a result of this pact, many items on Canada's export control list never required export permits for sales to the US. Global Affairs Canada explicitly wrote regulations exempting itself from administering Canadian law for most weapon export to the US. That means that most Canadian weapons, components, and ammunition can end up in US-made weapon systems that are later delivered to third countries, all without reporting tracking, or auditing. While this loophole was designed to counter the so-called Soviet threat of the Cold War, in the decades since, it has been vastly repurposed to serve U.S. imperial and military interests, particularly across the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia, where the U.S. is involved in covert forever wars, both directly and through proxies. Between 2014 and 2018, Canadian company General Dynamics' large light armored vehicle program saw vehicles and parts end up in cross-border operations into Yemen. Several government reviews questioned whether those reports were being used unlawfully. In fact, between 1993 and 2015, Canada estimated to have exported more than 2,900 LAVs to Saudi Arabia, many of which were routed via the US. Those exports alone totaled approximately 2.5 billion Canadian dollars. All of this was made possible through the same opaque transfer routes. This intentional circumvention of Canadian law has allowed its arms and components to contribute to war and atrocities around the world, while giving Canadian politicians plausible deniability.
When we look at permits for export to Israel in particular, in recent years our government has not received and therefore has not approved any export permits for weapons.
Today that same system is enabling the shipments of weapons used to fuel Israel's genocide in Gaza. This loophole is more than a legal technicality. It's a gateway that allows Canada to arm conflicts while avoiding scrutiny. But every shipment, every component, carries real-world consequences. In Gaza, there has been at least 96,000 people killed by North American-supplied munitions. By leaving this loophole open, Canada is digging itself further into complicity in human rights abuses and war crimes. Its own laws and the arms trade treaty obligations it has signed are being vastly undermined. International law is clear. Knowingly supplying weapons used in genocide or war crimes can trigger accountability at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Closing this loophole is not just about ethics. It's about protecting Canada from legal liability, restoring transparency, and ensuring that Canadian arms are not used to commit atrocities. It's about making sure Canadian policies matches Canadian values, upholding human rights, respecting international law, and refusing to enable genocide and war crimes abroad. Without action, Canada remains on a dangerous path, legally exposed, morally compromised, and complicit in the deaths of civilians. But why isn't Canada closing the loophole? The biggest reason is political will. The Canada-US defense partnership is deeply entrenched, politically, economically, and militarily. The DPSA and NORAD have made Canada's arms industry dependent on US contracts for over 70 years.
Over 50% of our arms exports are to the United States. But we don't know the actual percentage because those exports are not only not tracked, they aren't reported. And so we have no idea how many of our arms are being sold to the United States.
Closing the loophole would mean introducing independent oversight on U.S.-bound exports, something Ottawa fears would disrupt the North American defense supply chain. Simply put, it would anger Washington and complicate Canada's seamless military integration with the U.S., raising the question, shouldn't Canada be acting as an independent country? And while politicians frame the loophole as efficiency, in reality it keeps Canadian defense manufacturing dependent on US war production, which often fuels wars like in Yemen and the genocide in Gaza. Maintaining it provides Canada with both legal ambiguity and political cover.
Any exemption that we provide the US is not a loophole.
This allows the government to maintain public messaging like Canada does not send weapons or issue export permits for Canadian companies to sell weapons to Israel, while knowing full well that Canadian components are ending up there. It's plausible deniability mechanism built into law. Politically convenient, legally indefensible. And because the government refuses to close the loophole, the only way to do so is through a private member's bill.
Speaker, I rise today to introduce my private member's bill, the No More Loopholes Act.
If you're set to retire this year and the corporation you work for goes bankrupt, there's a law that makes sure your pension is first in line to be paid. That's Private Members Bill C-228, introduced by Conservative MP Marilyn Gladue in 2022. Canada's foreign aid is now more transparent thanks to Bill C-293 by Liberal MP John McKay in 2007. Parliament has hundreds of MPs, so after each election, a lottery runs to decide the order in which each MP can propose their own bill, one of the few tools that MPs have to push legislation outside the government's agenda. Given there are 343 MPs, not everyone gets their bill debated by Parliament before the next election.